Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we have been doing for the last almost 10, actually a little bit over 10 years about try to understand the energetic cost for biomolecular machine. I call it biomolecular machine, but we're really, what I'm mostly talking about is not machine in the usual sense. You will see in a bit. So here are my collaborators. There are three systems I'm going to talk about. I'm probably going to just end up talking about two, and both of that has rings in it, so I call it tale of two rings. The three systems I'm going to tell you about are biological switches, very sensitive switches, adaptation in cellular biological systems, not adaptation at the population level. And at the end, I will talk about the biological clocks. So here are my collaborator in different parts of this work. Before I actually go on, does it go? There's an advertisement. So not too far from here, south of here, about 37 miles, Ventura. So we're going to have a Gordon conference in almost like a year from now, right? So this Gordon conference is a new one. It was established in 2011 by the originator, the founding, chairs are Ken Dell, a lot of people know from the protein folding, and Hong Chen, a lot of people in the non-human thermodynamics literature knows about him, my friend, and also. So next year, it will be, again, held in Ventura, and the general subject is on stochastic physics in biology. So I think a lot of the stuff that's being talked about here is rightfully belong there. So if you have ideas, organize. So I'm going to go down to Florida, have my training in January. I don't know any of you have served on GRC president. Actually, Jin did that a couple years ago. So it was just officially approved, and I'm going to go have the training. So the planning hasn't really started. So it's a good time if, I think all of you are welcome. But if you want to organize something in particular, talk to me. Okay? All right. Now, first slide. So we are all physicists, so this is where the question has been asked. Not all of physicists. You are physics synthesizer. How's that? Okay. All right. So this is actually, I didn't realize it's a 75 years anniversary of this book that Rob told you about that yesterday. That he wrote a book, Schrodinger, this is after the glory days of quantum mechanics. So he wrote a book about, he's thinking about how biological systems are different from the physical systems. Right? So he has various hypotheses, conjectures. Most of them turn out to be not so right, to put it mildly. But there was one thing he mentioned which actually turned out to be, cannot be wrong. I mean, this is actually almost a statement. That life feeds on negative entropy. This is, his writing. My interpretation is that he observed life in its way of rhythm in time, in its way of having spatial regularity. So you have spatial and temporal order in this thing that is totally against second law of thermodynamics, right? So therefore, he says it has to, basically what he's saying is it has to consume energy to generate this order. Order comes from dissipation of energy, some way. So we try to figure out what that some way might be. So in particular, I'm not going to tell you, all the things I'm going to tell you center around a central question, which is basically how do living systems process information accurately? So accuracy means that there's some order, right? These components, proteins and so on, DNA, they make a lot of error, mostly because they are, these components are noisy, not because they want to be noisy, just because they live in finite temperature. Room temperature is very, very hot in terms of physics, right? It's hot. So it fluctuates a lot. And also, the number of molecules involved in these reactions are really, very small, right? Compared to Avogadro number. So that's, these two factors tell you that there's a lot of fluctuation involved. And yet, it has to do the things it wants to do reasonably accurately. I tell you why, I'm not going to tell you why it has to be accurate, but just take for granted it has people from empirical observation So you have replication, the error rate, I'll tell you a little bit about that, which is very low. And pattern formation, you always form the seven stripe, you know, so how does it happen? And a circadian rhythm is something I will tell you about today. And also learning and memory. So in neuroscience, you know, this firing of neurons, they are very noisy. And how come they have, we have very concrete, very clear thoughts coming out this way? I don't know. For some time. Yeah, okay. So we, I mean, my line of research has been in two lines, right? So most of the time I spend, I try to work with biologists, try to understand the question of how. How does actually work, right? These molecules interact with each other. How does it give rise to certain desirable function? So I work on biochemical networks and its function. So recently, in the last 10 years or so, I started to think about, now since we start to understand the how question, then we ask the how much question, right? So okay, you can do this. So magic. This is not black magic, right? You have to have something to drive it. So what is the driving force? And how does the driving force relate to the actual function you try to achieve? The relation between function and energetic cost. So biologists have this slogan, right? So, structure determines function. And they forgot one thing. You have the structure which allows you to do something, but you have to drive the transformation within these structures to actually do that thing that you want to do. So I want to put that into the equation, right? Okay, so that's just another tangent, right? So so why you worry about energy and information processing, right? So if you think back in the history of computing, so generally I'm not going to tell you anything about the actual mechanical work that biological systems also do, like the motors and so on and so forth. Today is all about sort of related to information processing. So the cost of information processing has been thought about in the early days of computing, like by my former colleague Ralph Landauer at IBM. And he actually formulated the problem in such a way that actually he has a very clear conclusion. So basically, he says that in this very obscure journal called IBM Journal of Research and Development, published in July 1961, he actually proposed what now people call the Landauer's principle. What is Landauer's principle? Actually, this question was asked originally by von Neumann when he was looking at these computing things. As is there a minimum cost for doing some operation, bit operation that actually process information? But he never was able to formulate it in such a way that actually have a clear answer. Now, Ralph, after he sort of simplified the problem, was able to show that each bit of lost information will cost a minimum of kT log 2 of free energy. So what he was saying is that it's an irreversible process. Once you write it, you erase it, you cannot go back because you don't know, when you erase it, there's two possibilities to go back. You either be 0 and 1. Whereas the erasure, it doesn't matter you are 0 or 1, you erase it. Then so it's an irreversible process. And the reduction or increase, depending on which direction you go, of entropy is exactly a factor of 2, right? You have one possibility, you know it's 0 or 1. Once you erase it, when you go back, you have two possibilities now, 0 and 2, 0 and 1. So the ratio of the number of states is exactly 2. So that's where the log 2 comes from. And you live in the kT, so the environment has to supply kT log 2, a minimum of kT log 2 of energy for in order for you to actually do that operation. So that's Landauer's principle. So that's the kind of, yes?
But if you want to create a bit of energy, is that the same amount of energy?
No, because so you have to go to a loop. So that's the thing. So if you write it, it may cost some energy to actually write it, but the energy was stored there, right? So only when you have to go back to the original state, when you finish the cycle, that's actually when you can talk about what is the dissipation, because you have the beginning and the end at the same state, and you ask in the process of that loop. That's how at least I understand. All right, so I'm just saying you cannot really partition it to be writing and removing separately. Okay, so that's the origin of why I asked this stupid question, right? So, okay. I asked the question about, okay, what about the energy cost of information processing in living systems? So, of course, it's not a digital computer. inside the cell. So, but can we even ask this question? And the overall answer is yes. Okay, now, when we talk about energetics, you open up a textbook, the number one thing is that, and number one thing for physicists to understand is these two, right? Okay, you want to move stuff around, you do work. You need energy to do work, so we understand that. But you also need to synthesize that. You could build a bound. Chemists really understand. So some, chemical physicists understand this also, that you actually build bound and need energy. Okay, so these are the two things that people actually do understand, do appreciate, I would say, right, and learn and they study a lot. But if you open up a book by Bruce Alberts, the Bible of cellular molecular biology, you find these different usage. So this is what we talked about a lot in this conference, is how do you actually make the ATP, but also you make it so that you can use it, right? So you have synthesis here, transport, motility here, pump and heat. I was just talking about the energy, the cost for you to pump so that you can maintain certain gradients. It's all good. But I said, there's another thing that people really don't have, not too much ideas about. It's actually information processing. How do you do regulation? This is actually directly related to what Jonathan was talking about this morning, is that how do you even generate the oscillation in the first place, right? You're not making anything. You're not, moving things around. Maybe you do a little bit, changing the conformation, but you're not traveling over long distance. So that energy cost is actually trying to regulate, to control, and maybe in the brain to compute, to encode memory and so on and so forth. So that's the energy cost I'm concerned about in my talk. Now, this is a slide stolen from, I steal from Mike gave it to me very kindly. but he said it's maintenance. See, remember, I did change something. You put the maintenance here. I would say running cost, because it's actually trying to not maintain, not something broken, you repair it. It's actually running it. The machine is there, you made it, you might have to pay some price to repair it, but the running it costs energy, right? So this is the part I'm going to focus on today. And let's just step back a little bit about machines. We talk about machines. What about our human-made machines? So think about machines that we make. The machine we make are, like the machine we make, this very elaborate machine that we make can allow us to transport from position A to B with a large cargo, with all the components built so that you can, put fossil fuel or electricity. In these days, actually, you can move from place A to place B with a load, right? So that's actually, people can understand that. We build this machine. But off recently, we also build another kind of machine in mass. So this is also a machine, right? Nothing is moving very fast, not very long distance there, but things are moving very fast locally, electrons and so on. And that costs energy. And the result of that energy cost is not to move things around, but it's to compute, it's to obtain, extract information. You have input, after something done, you get an output, you get an answer, right? That's what you do. Actually, I just got from the internet that this is a year old now, that actually 5% of all energy consumption in the United States goes just to running computers. Right, that's a pretty alarming large number. Yes.
Do you have any idea which computers are we talking about?
Like, no, it's mostly servers, mostly doing the cloud servers that store all this. So they actually have to build near them, so that they have to have a lot of electricity going through them, so that actually they can run these things mostly for cooling. Well, the heat generation, all the things going on. So okay, so that's a major concern now.
So like her these seven computers, how far away, how efficient are they in terms of computation?
Not very efficient. Okay, I don't have the slides here, but I have it somewhere else. So that's actually a fun slide. So Ralph Landauer, because he was really interested in this, he did a plot of per bit operation cost in picojoule. So he actually plotted from since the 50s, when he started to keep record, all the way down to, by the time he was doing that, it was about early 90s and so on. And if you plot in the semi-log plot, it goes down exponentially. It's like a Moore's law with exponent, like every few years it goes down by a factor of two and so on. So, and that, in the same plot, you have KT log two. So it's projecting. Supposed to be in 2013, we will already be hitting the Landau limit. But you know, he passed away, he has no. but the curves start to level off.
We're very, very far from the thermodynamic optimum.
We are
like how far?
About 100 or to magnitude. Yeah, well, three orders of magnitude.
But part of it is like even conceptually the way that we build computers, you tend to maintain the state of a bit by running a current through, you know, a resistor. And so like that already is something that, you know, you need energy to maintain the state. So
right.
It's already very far from the Landau.
There is a second factor. Landau already said you need an infinite time to erase.
Yes, it's very slow. That's right. You're right.
And I was going to say. You have 1/T. So you want your computer fast, you pay something extra, which is A/T. And T is the time for the operation.
But the device also have the different device. You see, you have a dimensionless number, right? So it's not just 1/T, but something in the denominator that you can actually change by technology. So that can go down, right? So you can do a faster without costing additional energy by slowing it down, but by saving energy by slowing it down. But anyway, all summed together, what the current technology at is at like three orders of magnitude away from that.
Just one comment.
Yes.
This is something we had plotted at Intel. So
right, I would imagine.
It's actually 10,000 KT. If you assume the Landau is KT log 2, in 2013, when we looked at the desktop, the mobile, and all that, it was around 10,000 KT. So it's 10,000 times less efficient.
Yeah, so I said 10 to the third power, maybe 10 to the fourth. Something arranged.
It has come down to 1,000, so you're right. It's now closer to 1,000, but it's still 3 hours.
Okay, so let's move on. I think biology is much better in terms of closing the limit, partly because it doesn't have to be so fast, right? Because they actually can allow time to actually achieve that limit. Anyway, okay, so equivalently, we have the biological machine. So remember I said the car versus the computer, right? So we have the lovely flagella motor that you heard from Mike the other day. This is actually a beautiful, marvelous machine. So that's why it ended up on the creationist number one list of the proof for the intelligent design. So I'll talk a little bit about that. But of course, you have also this stuff, right? What is this stuff? That's when you open up the pathway handbook, you see all this stuff. It looks like a circuit, but it's really not a circuit. The link between two nodes are just through chemical reaction, right? So these are chemical circuit, if you wish. Its purpose is not to move things around, but it's actually to compute, doing some information processing. Like this is actually a circuit of neurons, so it actually is doing something really, really doing computing. So, okay, so going back to the question I asked about energy cost and how we do things and how much it costs to do things, right? So why do we want to do things at all? We can just, you know, let thermodynamics take its way. And so the example that you heard about yesterday, Rob Phillips, is a good one. So we keep using it. Is that I think that the true hero in biophysics, so interdisciplinary research, is John Hopfield. And everybody knows about John Hopfield's neural network work, at least in the recent days. But not too many people knows about in 1974. He actually came up with a scheme to do kinetic proofreading. The reason is that, as Rob was alluded to, is that if you just don't do any error correction, you still get a low error rate just because the incorrect base pair has high energy than the correct one. So e to the delta g will give you p, which is a small number, but that's actually apparently not small enough, right? So if you plug in the number, it turns to -3. What if you want to do better than that? What are you going to do? So you have to do something. So that's why you have to do something. That something is not work is actually increase accuracy, right? You want to do increase accuracy. So what John Hopfield did is just find, he proposed a very clever, simple mechanism to do that. the mechanism amounts to that when you build the base pair, you don't directly just say, okay, you build it, and you move on to the next one. You check on it. How do you check on it? You cannot really check on it. This is the correct one, incorrect one. You shake it. If it's very hard, the chance of falling apart is lower, right? If you don't bounce so hard, if you shake it, you'll fall apart. And you redo it again, right? So all these song and dance of having the intermediate state is basically you shake it, you check it. You check it by shaking it. And then the incorrect one has a high probability of falling off. As a result, the end probability of getting it wrong turned out to be p squared, okay? So p squared come out from the direct analysis of the circuit, this biochemical circuit. So the kinetic property of the kinetic circuit is what Hauffield did in his paper, and Nino also did that too. So here comes my other colleague, my famous colleague, Charlie Bennett. How many people know Charlie?
Not personally.
But you know him for something different, right? You know him because he's the father of quantum information, right? But you didn't know, in 1979, he did a study of the kinetic proofreading by looking at dissipation error trade-off in proofreading. Actually, to be fair, that he was doing actually reversible computing at that time. He was trying to figure out how to do reversible computing, how to go around the Landau limit, right? Or get as close as possible, right?
A lot of people in chemical physics also know him for Bennett acceptance ratio.
Okay, yeah, so he actually got his PhD in chemical physics from Ernie, what's his last name? Jeez. Okay, anyway, so he actually got a PhD from sort of a more physical chemistry background. Anyway, so what Charlie did was actually he took something like this and he computed the entropy production rate, and that's the cost. And he looked at the cost and how it relates to the accuracy, right? So that's what he did. So I want to be doing what these heroes were doing 30, 40 years ago for the system that we have worked on for in the meantime, because they only know this one particular system. And I want to extend this kind of approach, this line of thinking. First, this is how. John Hauffield figured out how. Charlie figured out how much. Okay, so I want to answer these two questions, mostly focus on the question that Charlie did ask. Okay, so the two systems, three ones, I'm going to tell you about two, is how living systems use energy to actually fight the second law of thermodynamics, or you cannot fight it, you have to spend some money to fight it, of course. But the three different examples. I will not talk too much about sensory adaptation because I feel this is probably something people know about my work in this area, probably knows this work. But actually didn't start here. It actually started with much earlier work in ultra-sensitive switch. Okay, so I'll tell you that. And there's some papers we published in this different area along with this kind of thinking, right? Okay, case number one, the ultra-sensitive flagellar motor switch, the work of demons. Okay, so this is a paper we published. I published over 10 years ago. I managed to put in Maxwell's demon in the title, which is a feat. To fight very hard to not let them take this away, right? And, I didn't show the other. So this actually was edited by Charlie. I couldn't get it published anywhere, but except in PNS, because Charlie was a member. He was, you know, sitting two doors away. So he said, this is cool. So anyway, so that was another joke. So what is Maxwell's demon? Maxwell's demon was really a construct. So it's just a concept that how can you actually go away from thermodynamic, second laws of thermodynamics. So basically you have this little guy, this demon, which sit here, which between two chambers, you say, okay, if you're hot, you can go into the bar. If you're not hot, you stay away from it, right? So these are like a bouncer at the bar, so the cool people can go in. You know, the nerds can stay out. So you end up with having a very high ratio of nerds versus the cool people. So, another bad joke. All right, so that's actually, but before people figure out that actually this costs energy to do it, right? The bouncer really, you know, these are big guys, you know? You don't want to mess up with them, right? Okay, two mode of rotation for flagellar motor. So we know about flagellar motor and the flagella itself. So flagellar motor are these things that about, the diameter is about 50 nanometer. It's really a marvelous nanomachine. You have each cell, each E. coli has around the order of 4 to 6 of them. And they rotate, they have two sets of rotation, counterclockwise and clockwise. When they rotate counterclockwise, the motor actually drives the flagella in such a way that they actually form a coherent bundle. So the cell, as a result, will move forward. This is called run. When either one or many, a few of this motor rotating clockwise, then this bundle will fly apart. And as a result, the cell will not move in the same direction, but it will actually jiggle, right? So that's the tumble. So both of which is very important for it to actually have motility as well as way of doing chemotaxis that sends the gradient and move up the gradient of nutrient, okay? So it's very important. Now, the transition between counterclockwise and clockwise, people also figure out, is controlled by a histidine kinase, QI. How many people knows about two-component systems? Oh, quite a few. Okay, so QI is the histidine kinase. Actually, no, it's response regulator. I got it wrong. So the response regulator is QI, which basically got the signal from the receptor, and then eventually diffuse to the motor and control the motor rotation. So the more QIP you have, the more likely you're going to go clockwise, and vice versa. Right. So that's the dynamics. If you look look under a microscope, the rotational either clockwise and counterclockwise, you have two states. You can either be zero, counterclockwise, clockwise or counterclockwise, or one. Right, so that's the simplification of the observable. So these are the observable, either zero or one, and you stay at zero for a certain duration and jump to one, stay there for a certain duration and back to zero again and so on. So switching back and forth. That's called the bacterial flagellar motor switch. Now, as I said, the switch is controlled by QIP. The concentration of the response regulator QIP will control the switching. Or in the y-axis is what they call the clockwise bias. What it is that the time you spend in the clockwise divided by the total time you spend either in counterclockwise or clockwise. And that ratio goes up as your concentration of QIP goes up, it goes up, right? So that's just what people know. But what people also find, this is actually a very famous work by Philippe Cousel, when he was in Chicago working with, and actually was when he was in Princeton working with Stan Leibler, they actually did the using FRAP to measure the concentration of QIP and simultaneously measure the bias, and they got this response curve. And what is surprising to them is that this response curve has a very, very sharp response with a Hill coefficient of order 10. You know, usually if you just have a typical biochemical reaction, your Hill coefficient is roughly 1. If you have a dimer, maybe you have 2, trimer, and a hexamer, you know. So it goes to indicate there's a lot of cooperativity in this switch. So where does cooperativity come from? Yeah, that's the question. So that's, here comes the first ring of the ring of two, the tail of two rings. The first ring is the C ring of the bacterial flagellar motor. This is a ring, the cytoplasmic ring, which is about, like I said, this is about 50 nanometer diameter. But this ring consists of actually 3 rings of molecules. The most important one is the phloem. It has around the order of 34. 34 monomer form the ring, okay? And QIP can bind to a monomer and somehow causes it to change its conformation from counterclockwise to clockwise conformation. Well, not necessarily phloem itself, but the rotation, okay? So that's the basic sort of cartoon picture. And then people start to model it, right? Okay, so we can think about, see, here we have a ring, there's something bind, and more bind, we have two states. Then you can go from one state to another state. Actually, we can actually model this by writing down something physicists are very familiar with. Actually, this biochemical, in biochemistry or biochemical physics, or chemical physics, it's called the Monod-Wiedemann-Shanzhou model. How many people know about MWC model? But basically, Monod-Wiedemann-Shanzhou model is actually an equilibrium model, by which we mean we actually can write an energy function. So the state variables are the two that observable, which is the counterclockwise or clockwise. That's the S variable, right? So it has a binary value. Another variable is the number of KYP, number of fly N monomer that's actually bound with the KYP, right? So that's little n. So the two state variable is S, binary number 0 and 1, and which is basically from 0 to 34. Okay? So that's the your phase space is 2 times 35. So you go in that phase space. And MWC model basically can write down for any configuration, you can write down energy, and in steady state, the distribution is Boltzmann distribution based on that energy. Okay, so that's what by equilibrium means, is that it's steady state distribution follow the Boltzmann distribution governed by this energy functional. MWC model, if you know about it, also have the nice property that the Hill coefficient can be as high as the number of monomers in that ring. So the formula is that the maximum Hill coefficient H is N, the size of the ring, number of monomers in that ring, times 1 minus square root of C, I tell you what C is, divided by 1 plus square root of C. What is C? C actually turns out to be, is the dissociation constant of this molecule, signaling molecule, to the counterclockwise conformation or the, versus the dissociation constant to the clockwise conformation, right? The ratio between the two, the dimensionless number. Now, if you go back to this formula, you see that the MWC model is a dead model when C equals 1, right? When C equals 1, H is 0. What does it mean? It's just a flat line. There's no response to QIP. So any response to QIP at all has to be, you have to have a C that actually less than 1. Okay, I'd write it this way, right? That C actually has to be less than 1. The more deviated from 1, it's in the other extreme, if C equals 0, then you have the maximum Hill coefficient, which is just the number of units in this ring, right? So that it goes from 0, no response at all, to the maximum Hill coefficient N when C goes from 0 to 1, when the ratio between the two. So this is absolutely the most important parameter in the system. It's the ratio between the two dissociation constant. Okay, now, it's all fine. So a bunch of people write papers. Schrapp was working with Howard. And actually, Tom Duke and Dennis Bray wrote a very nice paper mapping a ISIM model into MWC model. So you can actually look at different monomer have different conformation, and they coupled to each other through an ISIM model. And so a local field will be just the concentration of the QIP. And Bray and Duke has a annual review on biophysics on that mapping between the ISIM model on a ring to this problem, right? So very, very nice. Now, they're all nice and fine. Now, the same person who did the experiment at ultra-sensitivity, Philippe Cosel. Philippe is a wonderful guy, Dan's neighbor. Well, so he did another experiment. So he said, well, let's look at the, instead of just the average probability of being the counterclockwise or clockwise, otherwise the bias, I actually can look at the duration time, how long it stays in the counterclockwise or clockwise. I can look at the statistic of the duration time itself, right? The whole distribution. The information about the counterclockwise bias was nothing but just the first moment of that distribution. So why don't we look at the whole distribution itself? So that's what he did. So he did that. He get the full distribution. The black line corresponds to the counterclockwise, and the lighter line corresponds to the counterclockwise, the clockwise duration. Again, reasonably harmless as you QIP. So this is for different. Then he binned the data according to the bias itself, which roughly is a proxy of the QIP level, right? So this corresponds to high QIP level, where the time, the duration in, maybe I got it wrong the other way, the duration in the clockwise is much longer, right, than the in the counterclockwise. And the trend is actually right, no problem there. So we took a look at the data. What we immediately noticed is one thing very peculiar, is that I have this little peak here. So what's wrong with this peak? Anybody have any idea? There's a lot of things wrong with the peak, because if we think about just the two-state model, right, 0 and 1, you're jumping back and forth, maybe through some other state, a binding state, but by and large, you're jumping between, you know, 0 and 1 through a barrier. What are you going to get? It's a Poisson process, right? You're going to get exponential. So if you're adding all the complexity of the intermediate states, equilibrium intermediate states, you get a sum of exponential.
Not for first passage time distributions, right?
But this is not first passage time distribution. This is equilibrated.
But you could turn.
Yes, you could. That's what exactly we did. But when you the first passage time, when you convolute it with the arrival time, then it goes back to the Poisson.
There's something I don't understand about how this data is plotted. So what are they doing? They're looking at the. What does this bias mean?
So imagine you have a different level of QIP, which they cannot really measure. So if you have a particular level of QIP, then your average of the probability of staying in one state is given, right, in that sharp response curve. He says, well, let's look at all the cells with similar bias, which means similar level of QIP. So he basically doesn't want to convolute this curve with the distribution of QIP, which is bound to happen in different cells.
So he's collecting these trajectories.
He's collecting a bunch, many, many trajectories in many, many different cells.
And then subdividing them.
And subdividing according to their behavior. I mean, ideally, you would like to do it with a fixed QIP level, but they can't already do that. At least they haven't found a way to do that. So they did it this way. So we did that. We say, okay, so let's try. When I first see the data, I tried very, very hard to say, okay, even given this, remember 2 × 35 state, I can put in all different rates here, but you know, I can play around with this rate. Equilibrium thermodynamic just says that if you go through a cycle, the rate has to, the product and counterclockwise has just to be equal to the counterclockwise. But that only gives me so much constraint. I have a lot of other things I can play. I can put in different weird function of transition rates and whatever, right? As long as I satisfy this, what happened is that as long as I satisfy this, I was never able to get a peak or even a shoulder. I always get a sum of exponential decay. Then, so that triggers me to say, well, you know, what's really going on? So I was able to show, to prove, I haven't really, you know, proved any theorem rigorous sense, but this is as far as I can get as a physicist, okay? So for all equilibrium system with detailed balance, or equivalently, if the rate satisfies thermodynamic relationship, the steady state dual time, right, in a given state, this can be a macroscopic state, by the way. So if you have a bunch of states, remember, we have a bunch of states here. We call this blue, green, and call this all red. So we are looking at the dual time, the residence time in either green or red. Doesn't matter if you're this green or this green or this green. Okay, that dual time distribution can be a sum of this. So this can be easily proved. But what I did prove is that A of I is a sum of square. Okay, sum of scale, which means that it's positive definite. This time scale, by the way, is all positive. So it's decay. So that basically says it's actually a sum with positive coefficient of all decay functions. Therefore, the overall function has to be a decreasing function. Not only that, the third derivative has to be negative. The second derivative is always positive. and so on and so forth, right? So you can do, you can show that. All right. So no, in other words, no equilibrium theory. So this is a challenge. I don't want you to take the challenge, but no equilibrium theory such as the MWC model or whatever IZ model can explain this data. Yes?
Do you have to assume that the kinetic network is finite to prove that? Because it seems like if you had an infinite system, you might not be able to find...
No, I think this N can be... So, okay, one thing is that this network is equilibrium. That means that this already, this is a real number, and it's positive. So what's hard to prove is actually A of I is positive definite. Because in non-equilibrium system, what happened is that you can still do this. If you don't have oscillation, you can still do this part, but A of I is not positive definite anymore. Or, in other words, it can still be positive for some cases, but it's not guaranteed. It's only in the equilibrium system that it's actually a square, sum of all squares. And the square, and in each of the square, it's only zero when it's equilibrium, when the cycle rule is satisfied.
You probably need every state to be accessible, so you need it to be irreducible.
Oh yeah, you cannot have any inaccessible hidden states, right? So all the state has to be there and allow you to tunnel in through in and out, right? Okay, so go ahead and this is all in supplemental material, of course, the proof itself, but it says. The key I can tell you is that proving A of I is a sum of square. Okay, so...
Can you try to explain one last time, what is this data exactly? On the next slide?
Oh.
Like how was it generated?
Okay.
Like the gray versus black, what does each dot mean?
Oh, okay, so the gray versus black is just, remember you have two states. Mm-hmm. The gray corresponds to one state, another one corresponds, the statistics on one of the states, and the gray corresponds to the statistic on the next state. What is the statistic? Statistic is you have a time series of up and down, right?
Yeah, the rotation clockwise.
Clockwise. Yeah. And you just collect this time scale, and you put them in the distribution of this time.
You look on the bacteria in the microscopes?
Yeah. What they do is they have a tethered cell experiment, right? Or tethered bead. So anyway, you can look at the rotation, and you can easily tell if it will come to clockwise or clockwise.
Okay.
So you get this 0101 signal,
okay.
And you look at how long does it stay in the counterclockwise state.
Okay.
And you look at, so the switching time is not this time you're worried about, it's actually how long you stay in the particular, it's the persistent time.
So the x-axis is how long it stays?
Exactly, and the distribution is the count.
But how do you,
just histogram. And different plot correspond to different, like I say, this statistic depends on the QIP level. He has no access to that. But QIP level, this is a proxy for the QIP level. This is a high level, low level, and so on. Right.
Do you know how long these individual? I mean, something about subdividing the data like this makes me uncomfortable. Like,
It makes us uncomfortable too. This is actually the standard argument that this data is bullshit. Because you cannot. It's actually going against a lot of resistance from very important people like Steve Block. The first, I didn't show you this. The first experiment of this sort was done by Steve Block while he was actually Howard's student in Howard Berg's lab. So what he did is actually he actually did this plot, but he didn't separate the cell according to the bias. He didn't even separate, and his resolution is poor. Very poor. It's like, I don't know, 0.5, at the most 0.1 second, probably 0.5 second. You see the peak are the best peak, right? Here's the best peak. It's 0.5 second. So nobody can dispute this given that this experiment's resolution of detection of the persistent time. Because remember, even though 0.5 second sounds small, the cell is rotating at 10 to 100 hertz. You're already rotating 5 revolutions or 50 revolutions. That is not disputable. If you only rotate like a half a period, then yeah, you know.
But for data like this, if you subdivide it in this way, where
yeah, so we did that. We did that. If you do, you use the model, and you can do this, right? With a model, you can do this. When you subdivide it, it can even make things worse. When you see a peak, it definitely is a peak. Because when you bunch, so this is still a range. It's between 0.85 to 0.95, okay? It's 0.5, 0.9. Now, even within that range, if you sum over different distributions, it's going to be broadening your peak, right? Make it less visible. So if you see it with a bunch of cells bunched together, the chances are it's there. So the summation, the actually, if you look at population average, most likely you're going to see some feature that's more averaging than having a peak.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess my point is that if I take a model, a three-state kinetic network
right.
that satisfies detailed balance,
yeah.
I can find trajectories that will satisfy biases of the same degree.
Yeah.
Here. And, I don't know what you would get, but I imagine...
You would not get this. Try it.
We
tried that. We tried even better. We tried four states. Okay, that's because you have two up, two down. Three, of course, is easy. You actually can solve the equation, but
yeah.
You can exactly solve it. You're gonna okay. That's a good exercise. I want to know the answer tomorrow. And you can start adding flux in it, and you see the peak developing. You actually can see the peak can develop because one of the coefficients become negative.
So
right?
This might be another way of saying there's a time reversal symmetry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's why.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yes. Basically, whenever you see a peak, whenever you see a deviation, so, okay, here's another thought. So I'm not going to finish the talk. I'm just going to talk. What is time reversal symmetry in stochastic dynamics? So Poisson is something that satisfies, let's say, so it's the simplest dynamics that you can have in a stochastic system. And Poisson, in some measure, I know exactly the measure, if you have the average fixed, Poisson distribution has the highest entropy. Okay? Any distribution with the same average that deviate from that, in particular, deviate in such a way that your average time, your variance, is smaller than the Poisson. That means some control has been happening to control the reversibility of the system, right? So that's why I think having a peak is a very clear indication you're deviating from Poisson. All right, so we did that exercise. We couldn't figure out how to do this. Then we say, aha, now, let's put this coefficient gamma, this magic gamma. So in all our paper, now you know where the magic gamma is allow us to go away from the equilibrium rates. So if I have the gamma, if gamma equals 1 or gamma 0 equals gamma 1, then the circle rule is still satisfied, or the thermodynamic constraint is still satisfied. But if they deviate from each other, whenever you put in gamma 0 and gamma 1 not equal to each other on any of the link, right, then you break detailed balance. The whole system becomes out of equilibrium. And I don't really don't know where the gamma comes from, so I say it comes from a demon. So that's where the demon name comes from. It's not because it's really because I didn't know the detailed mechanism, but I know something is there doing something, so I call it a demon. Actually, you have two demons, one go up and one goes down. All right, so does it actually even work for this particular system, right? So you can say, okay, it necessarily has to break detail balance, but of course, it really, really depends on how you break it. So lesson number two is that energy dissipation is only a necessary condition, necessary, but not sufficient at all in the whole space of non-equilibrium system. Only a very, very tiny part is actually using the energy correctly to do the things you want to do. And that's our job, to find out that little space to do it, right? Okay, so in this system, of course, I have some idea of why we should do it. So basically, if you enhance the transition at lower level of occupancy, so you have a boost here. But if I do it in a thermodynamic equilibrium way, I have to boost this up, I have to also boost this down, right? Because that's governed by the ratio cannot change. But if I break that, I can just boost it here. So gamma zero has a very high value, correspond to on this end. And gamma 1 will have high value on the other end, right? I just put this model in and see what happens. So as a result of this, you have a cycle, you have persistent, in a steady state, you have the persistent current going on. Probability current, not real, probability current in the state space. And the separation between the two enhancement is delta n. Let's call delta n. Again, delta n is fixed for this simulation to be, I forgot the number. Oh yeah, n low and n high. So the separation is 10. Okay, so I put on 12 on this side, I push up. On this side, I push down. And the separation is 10. And you see, as I increase, remember the gamma, right? Gamma equals 1 back to the equilibrium model. And this is the distribution. This is the histogram. It goes like exponential. And I start to crank up gamma. This is what happened. Initially, it started to create a little shoulder. Eventually, it start have a peak. And then when gamma is to the infinity, actually, you can only push it down to zero here when you have infinity. Why? Because that means that you actually only unidirectional. You have, so let's go back to your imagine you have a third passage time. How do you create a finite, a zero probability time zero is to prevent any reversible reaction at all, right? Once you reach here, it takes finite time to go the other side, to go up, right? If you allow any little bit of reversal reaction, you have a finite probability of going back immediately. So that's why you need to have cost you infinite amount of energy to create a zero probability here. But anyway, you can do this, and you see it actually works. Well, works in the sense of creating a peak. So now we created a peak. So what about function? So okay, before I do that, so we created a peak, and I told you it's non-equilibrium, blah, blah, blah. So I really want to have a measure of how non-equilibrium it really is, right? I told you gamma equals 1 is equilibrium. Gamma you go away from 1 is not equilibrium. So how do we measure the non-equilibriumness of the system? So here comes my hero, Terry Hill. Well, not here come. Here was my hero, Terry Hill. Terry Hill actually was, I think, the unsung hero of this whole business, right? So he figured out how to do dissipation, calculation of free energy dissipation and how to relate that in state space. Basically, again, this is our old friend, the flux in the state space. He was basically saying the dissipation, W dot rate, is the current in that state space times the chemical potential, delta mu. Okay? Some chemical potential measure, which is turned out to be KT times log gamma. What is gamma? Gamma is not actually not our gamma. Gamma is the ratio of the rate going counterclockwise divided by the other way around in the same direction of the current. So if you look at this formula, it's positive definite, right? One is the C minus that, another one is this thing divided by this, right? So that's always positive. It only becomes zero when gamma equals one. When the rate going one way, the product is equal the other way for any cycle. Of course, in this case, you only have one cycle. So we use W dot, the entropy production or dissipation rate, as our measure of non-equilibriumness of the system, right? And before I did do that, actually show you that actually when we change gamma, remember gamma equals one is the equilibrium model. Okay, by the way, I said something before about MWC model. MWC model, in order for you to do have a very sharp response curve, you need the binding ratio to be very different, right? The ratio of the dissociation constant have to be very, very small. So the binding affinity would be very different, need to be very different. This is all done without that. This is assuming the binding affinity is either very much the same or roughly the same. The C is equal to 1. So in the place of C, I put in gamma. So of course, because my C is 1, when gamma is equal to 1, that's a flat line. That's the equilibrium dead state of MWC's model. Okay? Now, even without C being increased from decreased from 1 or decreased from kept with 1, now I crank up gamma. So this is what happened. The response curve becomes steeper and steeper and steeper. And you look at the Hill coefficient. This is the Hill coefficient, effective Hill coefficient of this curve. Versus, instead of versus gamma, remember, I can translate gamma. For any given gamma, I can compute the dissipation of the system, right? Dissipation is basically dissipation rate times the average switching time, average time you spend in a particular state as delta W. And you see, as if you don't spend any energy and C equals 1, your Hill coefficient is 0. You're dead. Now, when you start spending more and more energy in the right way, push up left, push down to the right, you start to increase it, right? And this increase will saturate at a value. Remember delta N, the middle zone between I push up on left, push down on the right. In the middle, I don't do anything. The middle, delta N, that actually saturates to a value that is correlated with delta N. All right.
Johan.
Yes.
Is there a sharp bound? This looks like, you know, there would be a bound between H and delta W over KBT.
Oh yeah. This is a bound. Yeah, I don't know. Actually, this is something that you can probably work out.
Till tomorrow.
Till tomorrow. No, but what I was alluded to is that it both have the structure constraint as well as the energetic constraint. Energetic constraint is this line.
Yeah.
The structure constraint is this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that where do you put in this energy? The gap between the two regime, right? Between pushing up and pushing down, and this is how hard you push, right? The W, delta W, right? Okay, so. The last slide in this part of the story is that now there's a lot of dispute still at that time. We didn't settle the issue. We just threw in some more stuff in it. And people started arguing whether the detection was accurate, you know, all this stuff. They were school of thoughts and strong resistance to this point of view, right? So just recently, this paper came out by Junhua. Junhua was also a postdoc at Howard Berg's lab. He went back to China. This was done while he was in China. He basically studied. So we also asked the question of where the energy comes from, right? The energy, so you cost energy to do this. So where did the energy come from? But that's actually, to me, it's very natural. This switch is sitting next to a huge reservoir of energy called proton motive force, which is the very energy source that drives the rotation in the first place. And it's very close. The fly M, remember that ring, is sitting next to the rotor, fly G, which directly talks to mod A and mod B, which is the proton channel. So it's very easy for me to imagine, okay, as a physicist, that there's some coupling between the mechanical motion and the conformational change of the switch, right? So for me to imagine, so I actually even propose that. But are there any evidence for it? The answer is no, not yet, but we're getting closer. So this experiment, what they did is that, yes, the doubt is actually not totally unwarranted, because what the doubt was that when they measure it at a very low load in the motor. So these are original measurements are done at a relatively high load with a rotation of about 10 hertz. And we also heard the highest speed can be up to 100 to even 300 hertz. That's when the load is very low. So if you measure the distribution at a low load, it seems to be the peak disappears. Okay, so it does not, okay, one thing it shows that whatever it is coupled tightly with the mechanical motion because the load going through the motor and so on. So that actually indirectly show that our general way of thinking about it is correct. But they actually use it at the low load, they don't see the peak as evidence against the picture of a non-equilibrium model, which is insane to me. But anyway, that was the most recent experiment seemed to sort of resolve that. What they did is that they actually changed the size of the bead and sweeping through the range of the load. And they see, indeed, it happens only at the shoulder where the load is very high and it's moving in a speed that consistent. And when you change the load, they actually not only change the load, they also change the number of stator on the motor. They also change the viscosity of the media. And they also see, inevitably there are peaks, but the peaks go in and out depending on all these mechanical cues. So that gives further evidence that it's actually probably, if anything, what is driving it indirectly, directly, is at the force, at the mechanical force of the motor itself, which can trace back directly to the potomotive force, that is actually chemical driving force at the origin. So I think the hunt is on for the demon. So stay tuned. So we'll get them.
But you have this comment, like, okay, so obviously it's not worked out yet, but like, just, okay, so then if you say, think of that some of, okay, if you say that you're right, and then you said some of the energy is going into this regulation and some is going to the mechanical,
yeah.
Then if you were to, like, I don't know.
Estimate?
Yeah, estimate.
Very small. How much, very, very small, yeah, amount of energy going into the switching, because I can tell you exactly. So I think the amount of energy cost per switch in the ideal situation can be powered by a couple of proton motive force, couple of proton passing through. Okay? But remember, you only switch 1 second per every second or so. So every second you have two proton motive force. Each proton, I mean, to make one step in this motor takes you two proton motive force. And each revolution have 26 steps. And you go through up to 100 revolution per second. So it's a huge amount of energy cost for mechanics. So again, I'm not here, listen, I mean, I'm not advocating there's a lot of energy cost to do regulation. I'm just saying regulation really depends on energy. Doesn't matter if it's small or large, it's there. And tracing along the line of energy source for regulation may help you understand the mechanism. That's what we understand here, that actually because energy comes from mechanical part of the motor, so we really have to consider the switch and the mechanical part of the motor together as an integrated model. And that's the line we're pursuing. If I get time to talk about my second story, that's also not because there's a huge, in that case, actually, the amount of energy cost for regulation or synchronization is huge. But that's not the point, not the whole point. The whole point is, the main point is that by tracking the energy source, you may be able to help, you to figure out the mechanism itself. Okay, there was a question there.
No, go ahead.
All right, so I will skip totally the adaptation. So this is probably, if anybody knows anything that I have done in this direction, this is probably the work people know me about. So I saw in the first story, because that was not the first one I did along this line. The what triggered me to do this was really the motor switching work. Okay. All right, let me just go through this very quickly. Okay. Maybe I should do experiment for adaptation, which I always amuses people, and they have the tools to do it. So, I claim physics, the stable state in physics is this. This is a stable state, a little bit of fluctuation, just stay there, very stable, very boring, no energy input needed, just stay there. A biological steady state or adaptive state is this. Okay? So what do you need to keep it stable there? It has a lot of good property here, right? I can move very quickly here. It's unstable, so the resistance to motion is very, very small, can be made small as possible. So we figure out a mechanism in E. coli adaptation that basically uses this mechanism. So basically E. coli can methylate, this is a receptor. Along the receptor, each receptor, you have four methylation sites. Four is functional. And when you see you have more ligand bind, you want to adapt to more ligand, attractant, you basically add more methyl group to balance it. When the ligand concentration goes down, you start to remove this methylation group. At the end result, your your kinase activity down here depends both on the ligand concentration here and methylation here, will go back to the same level independent of concentration here, because I can always adjust my methylation accordingly so that my end result will be the same. That's called adaptation. And the way it does that, so this analogy goes so far, the methylation group increase or decrease correspond to the stick going left and right. So there are two enzymes, one called KR, which is a methyltransferase, one called KB, which is the methyl esterase, remove at methyl group, one is adding methyl group, like your eyes. If this one, okay, if you tilt it one way, meaning that you have higher ligand concentration, you see that it loses balance, it quickly, this is the two enzymes here, moves the opposite way so that it can balance. When you go the other way, you remove and adding so that you actually balance it. Okay, so what we figure out is that this machine, adaptation machine, if you wish, takes energy to run. Basically, when you observe it, you not only have to observe it accurately, you also have to move your finger. This is work. This work is done so that you can balance. Why do you need to balance? Because there's a fluctuation here. If this one doesn't change, you just stay there, right? But there's a lot of fluctuation here. To balance that fluctuation, you use this to balance. This is the control theory. This is the feedback control. And feedback control costs energy. And the amount of energy we were able to show is directly related to how fast you want to adapt, achieve the adaptive state, and how accurate you want to adapt. This relation, a triangular relation between the dissipation rate, adaptation time, and the adaptation accuracy. That's what basically that work was about. All right, so on to time. So there's a lot of oscillation in biology. Just give you a cell cycle we heard about, P53, another one that people often talk about, very important for cancer biology. But if you look under the hood, there are really not too many quote-unquote simple biochemical motif, network motif that generate oscillation. One of the very, very elemental one really is this activator-inhibitor model. So you have the activator, which activates X, and then the inhibitor will actually come back and inhibit R, right? Very ungrateful X. But okay, so if that's what it is, then you're actually going to die, because this world would just die, right? But fortunately, it has a self-sustained reaction, so R also activates itself. So the balance between the two, plus some time scale difference between these, will actually generate oscillation. So that's actually known. You also have, I think this is just the variance of this, what's so-called the repressor-later model. You have the rock-paper-scissor model, right? This will annihilate this. This will annihilate that. This will annihilate this. Then you go in the rock-paper-scissor kind of dynamics. This, I think, claim is the same as roughly the same as this, because if you annihilate this, this will be an activation, right? To that. Okay. So and another sort of, this is how people propose a substrate depletion model. But the most of the focus, we'll focus on details on this, but we studied all of these network architecture. And in all of this, again, I told you that this energy dissipation, and actually now we know how to compute, right, via Terahill, that we can actually compute the dissipation in this network. I don't want to go into details. This, we have seen it before. So the main thing of our work is connecting the function, the actual function, to the network dissipation in the network, right? So let's look at the function. What is the function? So you want to have an accurate clock. So again, in terms of function, we're actually focusing on accuracy of certain functions. So in the clock case, it's really about the phase accuracy, right? You have oscillation, that's okay. So to generate oscillation, yes, you need energy just to generate oscillation, just to push through the onset of oscillation. But beyond that, what, why do you need to cost more energy B? Does it only, you only need to push beyond the onset or the instability of oscillation, or you need to put more energy in? So that's the question we want to answer. So here, so what is the performance measure of an oscillation? Here, what I show is a 500 different independent oscillation that at time t equals zero are synchronized, but they only synchronize at t equals zero. Otherwise, it's free running, right? Then, so at t equals zero, if I look at the peak time distribution, it's a very sharp distribution because I synchronize them. I put them together, synchronize them. And then as the free running clock goes on, the distribution of the peak time for the second peak broadens a little bit, third peak broadens a little more, fourth, and so it keeps broadening. And we actually can look at the variance versus time. It goes linearly, and the slope is what people call the phase diffusion constant. Okay? The larger the phase diffusion, the worse performing you are, because you quickly got out of sync. So you actually can define a synchronization time, which turned out to be inversely proportional to diffusion, phase diffusion. The larger you are, the smaller number of, smaller time you have for a synchronized oscillation. So D large is bad. Okay, so this is a bad, so okay, so what we show here, so detail, I don't want to tell you more about detail. What we show here is for the, remember for the tree network that we worked on, the replicator falls into the activator inhibitor model. Okay? Just a simple a case of the activator inhibitor model. So if you look at the phase diffusion versus dissipation per period, you see the dissipation has to be bigger than some answer. So what happened in this region? You have no oscillation at all. You just don't oscillate because you need some finite amount of energy to drive through the onset. After that, so you can say, well, okay, after that, you already have the oscillation. Why do you keep putting energy in? You put energy in, at least in all these networks, to reduce the phase diffusion constant. So the oscillation becomes higher and higher quality. In engineer, you define a Q factor, which is higher in this case, right? So, okay, so we actually have figured out a way to, in some analytical model, we actually can deduce a relation between the diffusion, phase diffusion, and energy dissipation in such a formula. And empirically, you also have a saturation which corresponds to the degree of freedom that is not controlled by the dissipation, by the mechanism that's driven by the dissipation. So you actually, no matter how big you put more energy into the particular system that we studied, you cannot decrease it further than this.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can you just explain intuitively what do you mean when you say phase diffusion?
Oh.
Is it just a rotation?
No. It's just that your clock becomes it's supposed to be 3 o'clock, but sometimes it's 2:50 or 3:10.
So is it the dispersion you're talking about? Or
yeah, it's the dispersion. It's the variance of that distribution. It's the variance. It's this width. See? This width, the distribution broadens as time goes on. And this is the variance depend on time linearly, and therefore the coefficient is can be understood as a diffusion constant.
So it's a traditional diffusion, conventional diffusion.
Yeah, and the diffusion has a very physical reason because time translation is still invariant in all this model, right? So it's a flat landscape in the time translation direction, and no noise can just move it around like a diffusion. Okay. So I don't want to go into the much detail, so suffice to say that, yes?
So just again, in this example, so it's an example where you have a chemical network with the concentration oscillating.
Yeah, yes.
So concretely, what would represent, what would be the dissipative work, or what does the dissipative work represent?
Oh, just the phosphoration, dephosphoration? Yeah. So again, I'm not talking about moving anything around. Just things are still moving in a circle, but they are keep doing phosphorate, dephosphorate, dephosphorate, dephosphorate. All right. So.
So what's generating the noise? Just finite numbers.
Finite number of particles. Yes. So they see that this formula actually have a very important. It actually is inversely proportional to volume. So if you put more and more particle in, it still decreases d. With all the fixed constant, it still d. Of course, the go up with the volume is also delta w also, right? So.
But the external noise can also influence this, right?
Like, I wouldn't say external noise. External noise, but also I'll talk about maybe not too much. So externally, but more important is entrainment signal. So this is actually free running clock, right? So you have external signal like temperature variation of 24-hour cycle. You have plus some fluctuation on 24-hour cycle, plus the light itself. So this goes to, so I don't want to go. So this was published work and the strategy, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I don't want to go top. So this goes to the other problem that we worked on this, which is basically for a clock, you actually not only have to have a good free running period and low phase diffusion, you also want to be highly entrainable. An external signal, like you come here from abroad, you want to be entrained to local time. You don't want to have too strong a resistance to external signal. That actually is counterintuitive, or not counterintuitive for physicists, because it violates something that we're very all familiar with, which is basically fluctuation dissipation theory. Right? Fluctuation dissipation theory basically tells us that through via Braun and Einstein, I don't want to get to the jokes. So basically, Einstein relation is basically the diffusion or the fluctuation is proportional to the mobility, which is how easy you move, given external signal. Right? This is the response, this is the fluctuation. They are proportional to each other. In other words, if you want to have low fluctuation, low noise, no phase variation, in equilibrium system, you're going to have low mobility or responsiveness. Okay. So that's the problem. So that's the second work we did in this area. Is that of course we know in biochemical network detail balance and fluctuation dissipation doesn't satisfy, but it's still a question. Like I said, yeah, you can put in energy, so therefore the relation is broken, fluctuation dissipation. But you want to break in a certain way. You want to decrease the fluctuation, at the same time you want to increase sensitivity. Can you actually design a circuit, if you up to you, where do you put the energy so that you actually can do it in that way? So this is what we figure out in this particular network in the autocatalytic, in the brassulator model, how given the same dissipation, which is shown here, the cycle have the same product gamma, how do you partition gamma 1 here and gamma 2 here, gives a given same product, how do you partition it so that you can optimize responsiveness and minimize the fluctuation at the same time. So, okay, I don't want to get in detail with that. That again is published last year. All right, the last work that I really want to tell you about, which was just published last month, so it was also published. So, which is about something very fun. I think something that physicists will think about. And it's related to a well-known physics model, basically Kuramoto model of coupled oscillator. So there's a big problem in the chi system is what really drives us. Chi system is probably the world's simplest biological clock, right? Would you say that? The cyanobacteria is this bacteria that actually have a 20. It's probably the only bacteria, the family of bacteria that have a 24-hour clock. Is that right? Okay, so it's right. But anyway, the fun of this clock is that, as you heard from Lu Hua said, clock is known, 24-hour clock is known in biology. And in most cases, in mammalian cells, it involves transcription, translation, all that stuff, you know, together, very complicated, right? This cyanobacteria clock is extremely simple, to the point that Kondo in 2005 was able to extract three proteins, chi A, chi B, chi C, not very surprising. I think in Japanese, I think chi means something in Japanese. It's either time or something. So it's time. Chi A, chi B, chi C, and these are three molecules, and the most dominant player is the chi C molecule. Okay. And chi c form the second ring of the story, which is the chi c hexamer ring. Okay, so the hexamer ring is what I'm going to tell you about. But before I tell you about the ring, the chi c ring, okay, so here's the question. The question is, okay, the clock on the chi system is really run on this hexamer, right? Which is just like six molecules, plus chi A and chi B, which is on the order of one or two, depending on, I think six chi B in its four complex, you know, a fully bonded state and two chi A. That's it. So you have a very, very small number of molecules. So even though you can write down the chemical reaction for it to oscillate, for this particular molecular clock, it oscillates lousy. It's actually just terrible, right? So the way it actually also, even if you can oscillate, and if the two, there are many, also in a solution, there are many, many of this floating clock, if you wish. If they don't talk to each other some way, and they were out of sync, even they oscillate perfectly, if they're out of sync, when you do the average over the whole volume, you get zero, no oscillation. But I said, you know, but when the people measure the phosphorylation level of the whole soup, it oscillates perfectly. So which means that there's some synchronization going on between the hexamers, right? Okay, so that's the issue that we want to try to address. So we came up with the simplest model possible for a single clock. Then we couple them together, right? Chemically. So how do we chemically couple them together? So for each clock, the state variable is their phase, and we have finite number of phases. This could correspond to chemical state of this particular molecule, molecular complex. So they are characterized by their phase, phi I and phi j, and here is the coupling. So the processive motion of the individual clock is basically going either in the y direction or the x direction by chemical reactions, right? So this is basically this, okay? So this is one of torus, this two ring, and these two ring have a diagonal reaction. The phase can exchange. Exchange, so we restrict our reaction of exchange reaction to, in such a way that the total phase is conserved. Let's say the phase, because it's some kind of molecular state, let's assume the phase is conserved. So you have a transition from here to here and here to here. Okay? So that's we put those reactions in on top of the individual processive. Without the two red lines, it's the two independent clock running independently this way and that way. And then we couple them now, right? For the diagonal reaction. and it couples with the chemical reaction, which depends on, we can actually construct the ratio of the forward and backward can give rise to a effective energy function, if you wish, delta Eij. And the geometrical mean will give you the frequency of exchange, right? So basically omega and delta E, we define the exchange reaction rates, right? Forward and backward. So the model is all set. Now, before we go on to look at the property of the model, remember it's all about the cycle, right? For individual clock, the cycle goes 24 hours this way, because all the rates, product of this rate, divided by the counterclockwise rates, give you a number that's not equal to one. That means on running individual clock costs you energy, right? That was the conclusion of individual clock. Now, once I put in these exchange reaction in this higher dimensional space, I have another rings. I have the local rings, right? I have the local cycles. Consists of processive motion plus exchange. And this one is independent of this one. It's related to this, but it's independent of this one. And that also is not zero, not one, as you can see. And this is the main point, is that by introducing this, the effect, the function of introducing this can be synchronized. It is actually synchronizing. And the cost of the introducing this is that because of this, it costs you additional energy. So we relate basically the synchronization, which is the function, and the cost of energy in this study. So I don't want to go into detail, but there's a lot of nice mathematical property. We actually can solve this model in the mean field sense exactly. We can get a many-body distribution of all the phases. And that actually have a very simple expression. It's just the total energy as if the effective exchange energy is the real total energy. It's not. But what is non-equilibrium about it is that there's an effective temperature equals to 1, which will be the real thermodynamic temperature, plus a constant. So basically, this exchange and this processive motion is basically try to heat up the system. So this is K is the exchange, is the processive frequency, and omega is exchange frequency. Okay. So if omega is actually very, very large, they actually reach equilibrium in terms of exchange. And if omega is zero, the temperature is infinite, you have no synchronization. So somewhere, so as we know, in 2D mean field theory of coupled oscillator, you have a critical point. In other words, the temperature goes to a critical temperature, the effective goes to temperature that you go from asynchronized state to synchronized state. So that's a...
Yes? Can I ask you? I mean, for any non-equilibrium steady state, you can always define...
No, but this is different.
This is different, right?
This is all the... So that's the beauty of it. This is all local. So you can always define... This is all local. This is actually exactly the energy you would write down as if delta E is your real energy.
But
yeah, I understand.
But you have this expression. It's all sum over all I...
Exactly.
Chain, but this is because it's mean field.
It's mean field, right.
So the detail balance is preserved?
No, it's broken because beta is not 1. So beta equals, if this one is equal to 1, detail balance is preserved. But this is not, right? Detail balance is, right? Fluctuation dissipation is that the fluctuation is equal to response times kt, right? And kt in the equilibrium case is 1 in my formalism, but now it's not. So fluctuation is larger. Okay. So, but okay. So.
Sorry, a question.
Yes.
So, they are related. This is Fokker Planck in the phase space. Is that right?
Yes, but it's a multi-particle Fokker Planck.
Okay. Then the related question is the ratio of the two frequencies the way you
yeah.
got it there? Is it rational or irrational? Because that.
It doesn't matter.
No, because one could be a chaotic system.
No, this is the mean field theory.
Oh, and there are...
They're just, if they're synchronized, they're synchronized. No. Wait a second.
No.
Omega doesn't correspond to a frequency. It's just the exchange rate. K corresponds to a frequency of individual clock. There's no such, so you don't, and omega is always there with a probability, right? So omega is the exchange rate. It's a reaction rate.
But could it be an arbitrary number, or could it?
Oh, it could be arbitrary number, any number. Yeah. Okay. So here is a phase diagram.
I mean, so is your ET a priori defined, or is just?
ET is the sum of this energy. ET is the sum of the pairwise. So this is not really an energy. Remember, I defined the exchange rate forward and backward, and the ratio between the two. Give rise to delta E, but that only delta E only depends on theta I and theta J. It's all local, right? And I can write down exactly the expression. So whatever this is, the sum of over all the pair, all the mean field sense is the ET. Yeah, I don't cheat. ET is not the log of probability. ET, I know exactly the expression based on macroscopic interaction.
But it is related to your log of the probability, right? I mean, in the next view, your ET, I mean, where is it? No, there's a few lines down.
Yeah, ET yeah. is the sum of all the pairwise interactions.
No, but it is related to your steady state probability distribution.
Oh, yeah. But I don't define it as a log of the probability distribution. This, come up by solving this equation, come up to be this.
In general, you can always cheat and just call the log probability of your steady state your effective energy.
Right,
but this is a solution.
System, you'll get something non-local.
Right, this is a solution.
Yeah, but this each
not a definition.
You know a priori in some sense. Right?
No, you don't. I have to work very hard to get it. I cannot just take the log to get it.
Would that property persist if you did it on a lattice without mean field?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Kuramoto has an exact solution in two dimension.
So you would get kind of log, effective log.
Oh yeah, but that would be.
Lattice.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not even sure this formula. Yeah, that's a good question. If I don't have a mean field, can I still solve it exactly by defining a overall free energy as if it's equilibrium and then put a temperature here?
Presumably not.
But this is okay. Look, this is what I think is the equivalent of the beta ansatz for this equation. Okay. So I don't have all the interaction are local, and if you put it in, you treat beta as a constant. Actually, everything canceled out miraculously, as they say.
I'm still not sure what you mean by all the interactions are local, because the way that you've defined ET, everything, it's fully interacting, right?
Local in terms of pairwise, right? So it can be decomposed into pairwise interaction. That's what I mean. There's no three-body interaction or this actually high-order stuff. All right. Okay. So this is the phase diagram.
It doesn't matter that the I and J and J and I. I mean, I have a hard time to believe that, because the interaction, if you break the detail balance, the I and J and J and I should have some difference.
Yeah, it is different.
Oh, I and J and J and I.
Oh yeah, it is different.
So
by delta E.
Oh, I see. So you do have the asymmetry between the I.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So for example, in delta E, if you really interpret as energy, then delta E would either prefer the two phase to be closer or to be more apart. In this case, E0 positive means that it prefers, the reaction going to a state with two phase closer would be lower.
So EIJ and EJI are different.
No, I would, okay. There's no EIJ, EJI, they are negative to each other. Delta EIJ is EI minus EJ, okay, which depends on the difference between the two phase. But only that.
Something I didn't understand. Are you assuming that M is large?
Of course. That's the you solve in M is infinite limit.
Okay.
All right, this is the phase diagram. I mean, I'm way past my time. I just don't. So instead of the, so see, this is very different from equilibrium phase diagram in the sense that in equilibrium phase transition, you only change something that interaction strengths or temperature. The transition never depends on something with a time scale, right? Because it doesn't matter. But this does. It depends on how often you exchange versus how often you process. So this means that for a given interaction strength, if you don't exchange at all, you are in the disordered phase, the asynchronous phase. If you increase that, you actually can get into the asynchronous state by just increasing the exchange reaction rate. Okay. But of course, this E0 has to be larger than the equilibrium transition rate, okay, which assumes basically omega is basically infinite. That's the limit. Okay. All right. Okay. So for each one of the choice of this E0 and omega, you actually compute dissipation for period, right? And then you can look at the dissipation, how that depend on the space. And then you can come up with, this is the part that drives individual clock energy cost. This is actually synchronization energy, the energy used to drive the exchange interaction or reaction.
Right.
Yeah.
I labeled the clock numbers, right?
Yes. Yes.
So why do you have more currents?
This is a diagonal current. Remember?
Ah, I see. Uh-huh.
See, my network has more current now. So that's why it more costs more energy. Yeah. Okay.
This current, I see.
Okay, so this is the part that you can actually show this total energy cost minus individual clock energy is the driving energy for the exchange, for the interaction. It has to be large enough for you. This is the order parameter for synchronization. Has to drive the order by putting in enough synchronization energy. Okay, so that's the physics part. I don't want to belabor this. So this is part that gets into biology. All right, this is a real stories here. So this is so I want to be respectable in the audience about. So I show some pictures. So.
No movies yet.
You know, the cryo-EM is the future. No, this is a cryo-EM picture of the hexamer, of the chi-C hexamer I'll tell you about, right? So if you zoom in, actually chi-C, I'll tell you this, okay? Has two domains, chi-C1 and chi-C2. Chi-C2 is actually the one actually oscillate, not oscillate in terms of number, but it oscillate in its phosphorylation state. Chi-C2, on the C2 domain, there are two residues, 431 and 432. One is S, one is T, I forgot which is which. But they can be phosphorylated and dephosphorylated in which cycle. In other words, in each cycle, one chi-C monomer will be phosphorylated twice and dephosphorylated twice. In other words, two ATP is spent per cycle, 24 hours, per monomer. Okay? So that's the energy cost, or not. When people actually, here. So it looks like we need only two ATP, right, on the minimum. But when actually people can measure this, people, because chi system has been reconstituted in the test tube, people can actually measure the ATP activity. And they find something amazing. 16 ATP was consumed per chi-C per period, as compared to the two that's needed for phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. So where did the other 14 go? So that goes back to the domain number one, actually. This is one, I don't know. One actually is the ATPase. Between two monomer of the chi-C1, there's an ATPase activity site. That ATP can go in, get burned, and another one come in and burn, seemingly doing nothing. So what is it doing? There's another very amazing experimental fact that these hexamers, they exchange partners. Okay, so the way, okay, you have ways to, the biologists are very clever, they actually have can label one set of the hexamer and mix another set of hexamers not labeled, put them together and retest it again, and they find that pretty quickly, all are mixed. The one that is not labeled become labeled because probably monomer exchange. So that's why monomer exchange, and people actually observe this phenomena and to just leave it like that. So monomer exchange helps synchronization, possible, and maybe just being crazy. You know, this molecule, nobody knows what's going on, but this is observed, this is a fact. So what we're trying to do is to connecting these facts, right? You need exchange, monomer exchange, we actually do that, right? If you mix a 12 o'clock clock with a 6 o'clock clock mixed together, most likely it will come out to be whatever, 9 and 9, right? Or 8 and 10 instead of the two opposite, right? So just by entropic effect, mixing will actually help you synchronize. That's the hope. So what about energy, right? So we also know that synchronization costs you energy. So the fact that you have monomer exchange, and that helps you synchronize through monomer exchange reaction, and exchange reaction costs energy, probably can explain the additional 14, at least part of additional 14 ATP that's being spent. So here comes, so we basically did that model. We say, okay, you have the regular clock, phosphorylation, 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 dephosphorylation, dephosphorylation, dephosphorylation. And then on top of that, you have the coupling, you have the exchange of hexamer I, hexamer J, and the exchange. When do we exchange, this is an extremely good case that you have six, zero here, six here, it becomes three and three. But the real situation may be a little worse than this. But anyway, this is an illustration that through exchange, your two-phase, your phase is basically the number of red dots, right, on this molecule. Okay, so we have a model like this, and...
Sorry, what are the red dots? That's not ATP.
Phosphorylation.
The red dots?
Red dots are the phosphorylated sites. So it should be two, right?
The circle is a phosphorylated site?
Yeah. So this is...
And the dots.
This big fat thing
yeah.
is a chi C
yeah, yeah.
2, and the little red dot is the phosphorate.
Okay, then what is the difference between square and circle?
Oh, this it goes through, I mean, when it's fully phosphorate, it has to go through some conformational change. This is actually known, because otherwise, so this is predominantly phosphorylation, because it's in this circle conformation. Once it's fully phosphorylated, some conformation will happen. Actually, the more complicated. What happened is that this conformation then recruits.
Because this is a PDP circle. That's why.
Yeah. This is a DP part. This is a DP conformation, dephosphoration cycle, part of the half cycle. This is phosphorylation part of the half cycle. And the reason is that you recruit the chi B, which actually inhibit the activity of chi A. This one was binding with chi A. This one was actually binding with chi B, which sequests chi A, right? If you want to know the details.
Where did the 14 go? Is that from the exchange?
Exchange, exactly. So that's what I'm trying to show you. So R in this model is the exchange rate. How often does this happen? Do you see R here? When R equals to zero, the amplitude of the overall macroscopic oscillation is zero. When R has to be increased, so that you actually start to have this. So all the while, when you change exchange, it actually doesn't change the period, right? This is very important. Okay, so the period doesn't change, but the amplitude start to become non-zero once you push this towards R equals bigger than some critical number. And if you look at the overall cost, this is the basal cost, 2 ATP, right? You push, the energy cost go up, voila, when you have the when you reach some point here, and this delta, right, we put 15 here. At least this is a very much simplified model, right? It counts for a large part of the 15 or the 14, right? So that's the basic point, is that this, so that's what go back to the, I'm not saying this is a large amount of energy, you know, the cells, but I was saying tracking the trace of where do you spend the energy and how you spend it may help you connect different parts of the puzzle.
So they know when they do the monomer shuffling. So let's say you're down in the dephosphorylation stage where you're in this conformational change, and you have one, you sort of switch a monomer from your that's going through the phosphorylation part. So it's coming from a conformation.
Yeah.
You're going towards phosphorylation.
Yeah.
And it's entering something that's going towards
the yeah, yeah, okay. So yeah,
how much do you need to go between those two
states? No, actually you don't. You only swap in partner, actually in the later, I mean, the people know that so the model is actually more complicated than this. It turns out you only swap in certain phase. This is also known experimentally. I think that's probably correspond to the phosphorylation state actually control the ATPase. So what we think is happening is that the ATPase activity in the C1 domain is responsible for blowing up the hexamer.
And that's when you get the shuffling.
Then you get the shuffling. Because without the the ATPase activity, you're probably in the tight, or the ATP bound state is actually a very stable state, tight state. But when the ATP hydrolyzes, it goes to this probably loose state, which then can be, change partner.
And does the ATPase sort of accessibility is it affected by being in either your phosphorylation conformation or your dephosphorylation?
This is still, this is a good question. We don't know. I mean, I don't think the experimentalists know either. But I think, I strongly suspect it's all, this, the C2 has to talk to C1 in terms of either control the ATP accessibility or control the ATP-ADP nucleotide exchange reaction that allows it to go into the pre-shuffling state or so on. But in our model, we really didn't consider all the details. So that's probably why we have the number doesn't really, you know, I mean, we don't expect the number to match. But the point is that it does cost you more energy to go into this ordered state, to go to this side, right? When you push R. R being there is very, very much necessary.
So you're arguing that the phosphorylated state is somehow destabilized by the hexamers destabilized and then unbinds.
Yeah, we don't know how. So. Yeah, but it has to go through ATPase activity at the C1. So the C2 being highly phosphorylated may trigger something that allows it to release its energy in ATP, so that in the loose state. That's the way that the sort of.
Is there any indication of why this would happen? I mean, what's the advantage of doing this if you're gonna?
You wanna synchronize. That's what you wanna do, right? Isn't that a good effect? A beautiful curve going up. Just by doing something very simple, very dumb, right? I mean, very destructive for them to be, because I don't think this happens all the time for ATPase ring, right? I mean, its periods seem to be very stable. But monomer shuffle does happen, there's experimental evidence. ATP activity does happen. And so we put the thing together, and the energy cost is needed. So we put all these pieces together, came up with this little story that hopefully some experimentalists can check.
Is it a big cost, though, just making all the chi's?
Oh,
a lot of chi's.
That I don't know. For Kondo, he made it. He pre-made it and put the test tube. No, I'm just joking. No, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the cost of synthesize this clock.
It's gonna be a lot more.
Actually, you are right. I mean, the clock is not just doing nothing. The clock is controlled in vivo, is controlling the gene expression, including chi-C itself. So. But I don't know the chi-C halftime. It cannot be too short.
Yeah, but just the total amount, even if recycling doesn't happen, so you have to have a lot of chi.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's true.
If you don't have a lot, they won't interact and you won't.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, we're talking about 24 hours. Even for diffusion, even they're not so dense, they're going to bump into each other.
Experimental estimates of the exchange rate?
So that's the part I don't know. I think presumably if some people do careful experiment on this type of mixing experiment, they could get a time scale out. But so I think it's, see, this is hour, right? So I think it's about hour, because it's from not mixed to fully mixed, it's about 4 hours. So if I take 2 hours, right? So I would think it's about the range that we're doing here. That this is not too crazy, right? Yeah. So wait, one thing, it has to be faster than the 24 hour. You cannot, right? This is very important.
Not for like protein person. I mean, this is, I would say, it's quite slow, even for average protein-protein interaction.
Yeah. So it's not a very high, even though ATPase may happen at a faster rate, some of these blowing up may be just futile, right? So that probably explained part of the reason that, you know, this is not. So right now we're saying that they are very just exchange. So some of this ATPA may just burn and they fly apart and then just reassemble again without, you know, doing something useful.
This question is probably less about the biology and more about just your model.
Yeah.
Let's say restricted the interactions between the phases to follow some sort of like local pattern. So if like a clock here can only talk to a clock its neighbors, can you still get this type of crystal?
Yeah, so that's what Udo was asking. If you put on a lattice, Yeah, I think so. There's no reason. I mean, we know that the 2D XY model can have phase transition, right? That's just a phase, an angle, right? So we know it could, but it would change the critical point, and we don't have that nice solution. But I think in real life, in for the chi system, I think a mean field theory is warranted, especially for 24-hour period. Right? All right. Oh, last question.
Is this, what would be the beta exponent, let's say, describing this? It doesn't look like a mean field type.
That's a good question. Beta exponent, it's only a true critical phenomena person would ask. What a beta is or an alpha is. So we did something, this exponent is actually smaller than half. It's a quarter. You know. Yeah, anyway. Okay, thank you very much.